welcome, Red Ice members. Thank you very much for joining us. We are talking with Peter Levenda. We have been talking about China, primarily both the geopolitical scene over there, and also, of course, about some of the spiritual traditions and some of the Chinese alchemy and so forth. In this segment, though, in this hour, we're going to shift gears and talk about Peter's latest book called The Secret Temple, Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America. And I guess in one way, Peter, I would just like to begin to ask you about more generally about, you know, there's so much information out there right now on the Masons. This is beginning to be popular, as it were, not only through all the Da Vinci Code books and the angels and demons and all this, but why did you feel you wanted to dive into this area? Did it connect so much with your previous work on sinister forces and also on Unholy Alliance that you felt there was time for an update and bring the Masons into this, or what's your angle on this, so to speak?
Well, you're exactly right. There was so much in Sinister Forces and Unholy Alliance. Unholy Alliance dealt with the Masons to a certain extent because of the Masonic movements in Germany and the suppression of the Freemasons by the Nazis. But also Sinister Forces dealt with this concept a little bit. And I felt that I really wasn't approaching the subject well. I mean, it's a kind of word where you say Freemasons and everybody has a fixed idea about it, and there's no more need for conversation. So I felt that I had to clarify my own thoughts about Freemasonry and try to understand something which by its very nature resists being understood. It's a secret society, or a society with secrets, as they say. So how do we, who are not Masons, approach this subject matter, especially now that it's become such a boogeyman for so many people? I spent time in Indonesia since we last spoke, and in Indonesia there is a small group of people who are very interested in ideas like Freemasonry, and they share the same suspicions about Freemasonry in this Islamic country as you would find in Germany in the 1930s or in the United States this year. There are some of the same ideas. You know, Freemasons are out to control the world. It's a worldwide conspiracy. It's a conspiracy together with the Jews and the Zionists to control the world. I mean, all of these ideas are there in these books that are being written in Indonesia, showing pictures of the U.S. dollar bill, you know, and the pyramid on the back and the eye in the triangle. I mean, the stuff could have come right out of any of the conspiracy blogs in the United States or anywhere in the West. And yet here it is in a country which has not seen a Freemason, I don't know how many years, and certainly not seen very many Jews. And yet they've built this whole propaganda machine. So I said to myself, what does this mean? Why is everybody so concerned about Freemasons? When I was growing up, there were Masons in small towns in America, and it was like a society people joined to get business contacts and to network, that sort of thing. I never looked at it as particularly sinister. It's only with the passage of time that it's become that way. And then I realized there's so much misinformation about Freemasonry, as there is about America itself. And the reason America had a revolution against the British, is America a Christian country, which is something that's come up in this country now constantly. We are constantly dealing with this issue of, you know, America being a Christian country. Well, the founding fathers did not intend for it to be a Christian country. That was the whole point. And I think it's a point that's been lost. So I went back and I said, well, I wrote about the stairway to heaven. I wrote about initiation. I wrote about spiritual processes, spiritual transformation. The Freemasons embody this in their own rituals, in their own beliefs, their own practices. So let me see what connection there is and how can I explain Freemasonry to a wider audience.
What about the basic overarching idea of the official version from the Masons themselves? And is that separate from the more occult version that we get from some of the... Well, I know it's different, but would you say that it holds some truth, the alternative version to Freemasonry, as we get through the conspiracy research movement? Because I'm asking that question, I guess, also in terms of the fact that it depends on where you're coming from, so to speak, and what branch of Freemasonry that you're looking at. Because as in all hierarchy systems, there are many different layers and what the top know, the bottom might not know, and so forth. And is this a problem that you encountered as well when you're researching this, that it depends on who you're talking about, who is involved in Freemasonry, or what's your take on that?
Well, certainly it is. I mean, this is part of the problem. It's part of the problem with any group of people. Identifying the actions of the group with the actions of individuals is always a problem for any kind of academic research or any kind of journalistic approach. Hitler was a Catholic. Himmler was a Catholic. You know, was the Nazi Party a Catholic entity? You know, I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, where do you identify motivation? So when it comes to the Freemasons, yes, there were problems. The most famous recently being Propaganda Due, P2 in Italy, a Masonic lodge, which was basically a fascist, you know, hit squad, among other things. You know, they were laundering money for organized crime. They were laundering money for right-wing assassination teams throughout Europe and South America. You had neo-Nazis and Nazis belonging to this group. You had all sorts of strange people, and they were all Freemasons. You know, they were all more or less legitimate Masons who were members of this lodge, so including many Catholic officials and hierarchs. So you ask yourself, is that Freemasonry then in that case? Well, those were Freemasons, and that was a Masonic lodge that operated with impunity. Garibaldi, the famous unifier of Italy and the liberator of Italy, was himself a high-ranking Freemason. As was, of course, George Washington, and, you know, so many members of our founding fathers in the United States were Freemasons. Does that mean it was a Masonic movement? The answer to that question is not a simple one. I would have to say that the American Revolution was largely inspired by Masonic ideas and Masonic principles, which were themselves Enlightenment principles. Benjamin Franklin famously belonged to a Masonic lodge in Paris, which was notorious for being a liberal libertarian kind of lodge that numbered Voltaire among its membership. So you had this idea of anti-monarchy, not anti-government so much, but anti-monarchical and anti-clerical ideals that led to the formation of Freemasonry in the United States, and which led directly to the revolution. Masonic lodges were laboratories where like-minded people discussed these ideas, where they gathered together. They had meetings there. The Boston Tea Party was organized out of a lodge in Boston, Massachusetts. So the Masonic involvement with our revolution is so strong that you have to say to yourself, well, you know, the Freemasons can say they're not political, but they don't get involved in, you know, creating governments or overthrowing governments, but my goodness, in 1776, they certainly did, you know, and in Propaganda Due in 1986, they were certainly involved in these things. So the answer to that question is difficult to answer. If you go to your local Masonic lodge, believe me, they have no clue about any of this. And they largely have no clue about their own rituals and what they mean.
You know? That's what I've heard too, yeah.
Yeah, they don't know. They're just doing this. I mean, they know it fulfills them somehow. But you'll ask many Masons, say, we really don't know where our rituals came from. We don't know what they mean, you know, in the greater scheme of things. The occult esoteric aspects of it, they are clueless about. So Masonry is a very difficult subject in that case.
Well, absolutely it is. I mean, and I do want to get into a little bit of the rituals later, the initiation process, what potentially the roots of it, if you've come any closer to an answer in terms of that. But what about this idea that Freemasonry has reformed then? Has it become something else today than it was back in 1776 or what have you? Because what you mentioned here about this idea that they were revolutionaries in that sense, they were going against the grain, that's what we're being told at least, then, but when we look at it today, we have so many royals that are heads and grand masters and grand protectors of different orders. We have the British royal family, Duke of Kent and so forth, who are the grand master of the United Grand Lodge of England, and so today that doesn't, to me at least, fit into the picture then. Even Oddfellow here, we have up in Sweden, there are royal protectors of that order as well. So what has happened here? Something has obviously changed then, or have we been sold a lie? What's your take on this?
I think that in 1776, it was a different Freemasonry than exists today. I think in 1776, there were very strong ideals and very strong opinions about the rights of human beings, the necessity for freedom, freedom from tyranny. I think all of these concepts, and including religious tyranny, by the way, I think all of this was part of the movement that created the American Revolution. But I think, like anything else, once a society finds itself accepted as part of society, suddenly it becomes entrenched in that society. It takes on some of the worst aspects of that society. In the desire to become all-inclusive, you begin to bring people into your organization who do not hold the same ideals, who are not the same people as when you started. So you suddenly become, it becomes an institution. Like the Catholic Church for 300 years existed underground. It was persecuted. They had to meet at night in catacombs. Suddenly, with Constantine, they become a state religion. And within 1,000 years, suddenly, you know, the Catholic Church has become this monolithic operation which owns land, which controls governments, which decides who's going to be a king or not. I don't think Jesus, in his, you know, wandering through Palestine, had this idea in his mind. You know?
Yeah.
So the same thing with Freemasonry. I think that Freemasonry initially was a movement of resistance against monarchy, resistance against organized religion, resistance against any group that would try to tell you how to think or how to live. I think that was pure in that case. And I think, like the church, with the passage of time, and when it became almost a state function, that's when you saw corruption enter into Freemasonry. That's how you could have a propaganda due in Italy, where you could have fascists and right-wing, you know, assassins as Freemasons. I mean, there was no pretense at Masonic ideals anymore, at Enlightenment ideals. It was gone. It was disappeared. We were back to, you know, monarchy concepts. So I think that that's what happened. Freemasonry became sidetracked. I don't say all of it. I think there's a lot of Freemasonic organizations that are still trying to adhere to these ideas. But when you have presidents of the United States who are Freemasons, you naturally start to ask yourself, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. What does that really mean?
Yeah.
Washington was a Freemason. Our first president was a Freemason. We have no problem with that. But suddenly we have a problem with maybe Gerald Ford being a Freemason. Because of Gerald Ford's, you know, associations with other things, we suddenly question his membership in Freemasonry. It's a very difficult question, especially as Freemasonry is secret. This is part of the problem. It's the argument I have with Freemasons. As long as you keep your ritual secret, as long as you maintain secrecy, don't be amazed if people associate you with all sorts of terrible things.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
As I say in my book, you know, people who meet in secret are not benefactors normally. People are not giving you money secretly, you know.
Yeah.
They're not curing your illness secretly. If they're meeting in secret, it's usually for something that's dangerous. It's usually for something that, you know, we might frown upon you know, as the rest of society. So don't feel bad if we associate you with trying to control the world or run, you know, world governments and all the rest of it. It's your own fault, you know, for being so damn secret, you know.
With that being said, do you think they're still, I don't even know if they really want to have that monkey off their back, so to speak, because in one way I actually think that that's potentially even an attractor for many people, like, oh, what is this mystery here, you know, and as many people know that is sufficient enough to recruit new members because of the curiosity of what it actually is, so it might actually serve them at the end of the day. But if they would like to have this put to rest, do you think that their solution is to open up their doors even more than I have been doing in the last couple of years?
That might be a solution. They've certainly had a lot of Freemasons on the air recently. I mean, on the television documentaries, we have many high-ranking Masons and Masonic scholars talking directly to the public about what they do and who they are. They're trying to overcome this negative image. But, you know, I have another take on this, and it may be from out of left field, as we say, but I think that privacy has become an issue in the world we live in today. And it may be a strength of Freemasonry that it is able to maintain secrecy. This may be the only place these days in the United States where you can meet secretly and not be photographed, you know, and not have what you're saying or what you're doing wind up on Facebook or on Twitter or someplace on the internet. I mean, maybe this is a strength. Maybe this will be a strength of Freemasonry in the future, that it's off the grid that way, that it's not part of the general, let's let it all hang out, reality show reality that we live in, where everything you say or do is being recorded and transmitted. This may be a strength of Freemasonry. I think it was an impediment, an obstacle for them for so long. But I think in the next few years, people may look at this and say, maybe they have the right idea. You know, they're initiating secretly. They're meeting secretly. We're not allowed to know what's going on. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we all want to be part of this, you know, and we all want to be part of the secret so that we can have some place where we go, where we know we're, you know, we're safe. We are private, that there's not a drone taking a photograph of us from 80,000 feet.
With, you know, with so many denominations of secret societies as well, I guess one question pertinent to ask here is, how broad you draw the circle when you say that even the term Mason or Freemason, even that can be two different things if you want to be specific. But I mean, we have Knights of Malta, for instance, that on one hand, the Sovereign Military Order of Knights of Malta, that is on one hand a Catholic branch to all of this. But if you look at the Freemasonic hierarchy, they have a Knights of Malta level there as well. And we had a Canadian grand, I don't know if he was the Grand Master, but he was involved in one of the Freemasonic lodges of the branches of Knights of Malta on the show, and he said that they even connect at the top anyway. But we, on the other hand, then we have the Illuminati, we have all these different denominations and factions and so forth. And when you say Freemasonry, are you specifically talking about those who are officially recognized by the United Grand Lodge, or do you draw a broader circle than that, Peter?
A good question. For the most part, when I'm talking about Freemasons, I'm talking about the traditional Freemasons. I'm not talking about Knights of Malta or Templars or Illuminati or anything else, but just the Freemasons. You know, my book is about the Freemasons. However, when you say United Grand Lodge, I'm broader than that. The United Grand Lodge is one organization. I also write about co-masonry, which is a form of masonry which is more esoteric and which also allows women to become members. Yeah. So I write about that branch of Freemasonry. And Prince Hall Masonry, which was created by former slaves in the United States. So it was largely a black lodge, if you will, because Freemasons did not allow black people to become members for a long time. They did not allow former slaves to become members because they had a regulation that you had to be born free. You had to be born as a free man to become a Mason. So all those ideals of the Enlightenment didn't extend quite so far as black people, you know, or women. So, you know, there were problems there. So when I talk about Masonry, I'm talking about traditional Freemasonry, but United Grand Lodge plus Co-Masonry plus Prince Hall Masonry. I talk about the Illuminati briefly because there's just no way to talk about Freemasons without talking about the Illuminati. But when you talk about the Knights of Malta, for instance, and some of the other groups, you're talking about problem areas, too. I think that perhaps the Knights of Malta may be more problematic even than the Freemasons because of all the political connotations, all the political memberships, including CIA directors and everything else that have been involved with Knights of Malta. Skull and Bones, famously. Skull and Bones scares me, you know, more than Freemasons. I mean, here's a group that may have been an Illuminati lodge initially. There is enough documentation to suggest that the person who founded Skull and Bones was a member of the Illuminati in Europe. There's some documentation, and we're still working on really proving that. But Skull and Bones only initiates, I believe it's 16 people per year, which means that in a given century, you're only going to have at most 1,000, you know, 600 people alive who are Skull and Bones members. That's a very small percentage of the population. And yet, a couple of years ago, we had John Kerry and George Bush both running for president as the heads of their respective parties, and both were members of Skull and Bones. What are the odds of that? They're astronomical. You know, I mean, with 0.00001% of the population is a member of Skull and Bones, to have two of them running for president at the same time, you have to sit, and they won't talk about it.
Yeah.
They will not discuss their membership. These things bother me, you know.
Yeah.
These things bother me. I don't care if my neighbor is a member of Skull and Bones and won't talk about it. But if I'm voting for someone for president, you know, I need to know what their agenda is.
Of course, And where their allegiance stand.
Exactly. And if your allegiance is so strong to Skull and Bones, you will not discuss Skull and Bones because of the oath you took. Does that mean that your oath as the president to defend the Constitution and the United States, et cetera, is less somehow of your oath to Skull and Bones? This has always bothered me, as religious affiliations always concern me about presidential candidates and politicians. I'm very concerned about that. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, believed in, he had a sort of a doomsday Armageddon belief, you know, sort of George W. Bush have the same belief, believing he was anointed by God, you know. These things scare me. I mean, this should not be what I think George Washington had in mind when he created this country. He wanted that separation really made. I don't think he wanted the church brought into the Congress and into the White House as strongly as some of our presidents have. So with that on one side and skull and bones and the secret societies on the other, yes, I'm concerned. I'm definitely concerned.
If we say secret society instead of Freemasonry, would you say that that is the connecting body of the conspiracy to rule the world? Is that the lowest or maybe then highest common denominator? What do you think?
Well, you have organizations like the Bilderbergers. You have the famous Trilateral Commission. You have a lot of organizations which are, by their very nature, secret. They don't allow their meetings to be filmed or recorded in any way. You don't know what they talked about. And these are some of our world leaders. Those are secret societies. Why in our society, why anywhere in the West, and I'm leaving the East aside for the time, why anywhere in the West it's necessary for our political leaders to meet in secret is beyond me. I can understand our intelligence services have to do things secretly. We kind of suspend disbelief where that's concerned. We kind of give the intelligence services through our government and through our elected leaders a certain leeway to do things secretly. We realize these things must be done secretly. But why do our political leaders and our former political leaders have to meet secretly and have these discussions? Their reason is, well, if we're meeting secretly, then we're free to discuss whatever we want to discuss. We don't have to worry about being criticized for it later or, you know, or just coming back to bite us later. I don't know if that's a legitimate reason, personally. I think that I can understand that point of view, but I don't think that's legitimate because what they're discussing affects so many people on this planet that I think that some summary of what was discussed is necessary. I think that, you know, we need to know what's going on. It increases paranoia.
Yes.
It increases paranoia, and the same thing with secret societies in general, the Freemasons, all of this. Secrecy implies a certain degree of paranoia. You're going to be paranoid. It's like the UFO stuff, you know.
Yeah.
When the government does not come out immediately and say what something is, and when they maintain secrecy or they claim ignorance, all that does is increase the paranoia exponentially. And this is not a good thing. You know, whether they're doing nasty things or not, this secrecy is not helpful.
So where do you think the line should be drawn then in that sense? What should, even though you have a person who is a president or in some ministry position of a country or what have you, high up political business leader or something like that, do you think that they should have the right to meet in secret or when they attain to such a level of degree of leadership in society, they should no longer be able to meet under those conditions? Or is it okay, do you think, still for them to do this? Or should we make it illegal, so to speak? What's the solution here to that?
Well, I think the first solution is to recognize that our elected officials are there to uphold the laws as they stand. I think part of the problem is, part of our paranoia comes from the fact that in the United States, we've had a number of presidents who've broken laws and kept it secret. Obviously, we had Nixon doing that like a madman, breaking laws left and right. We had the same thing under Bush. We are in a situation where we cannot trust our elected leaders to do anything they say they were elected to do. So if, for instance, it is the law that no American serving in the military or in the intelligence services can commit an act of torture, if that is the law, if we know that a person will be taken out and prosecuted for that, and we can feel secure that that law will be defended by everyone who's elected, then perhaps we can relax a little bit about secrecy. If we know that corruption is against the law, if we know that these things are very clearly stated, who can do what is against the law, and people will be prosecuted regardless of the political party in power, et cetera, then we can relax again where secrecy is concerned, because we know that if they're doing something illegal, then it will be prosecuted. I think the problem that we have is we no longer believe that people will be prosecuted. In the United States, who is going to be prosecuted for extraordinary rendition, for instance, for the torture of political prisoners, there's still a debate as to whether anyone's going to be prosecuted. Mm. That's why we can't trust our elected officials. That's why we can't trust the secrecy, because the secrecy has led to excesses and has led to crimes. That's why we're afraid of secrecy. If we could trust our leaders to behave honorably, to uphold the ideals of which our respective countries have been created, then we can relax a little bit where secrecy is concerned. We can say, okay, they're discussing things that, you know, they don't want the outside world to know for whatever reasons. But there's such a fight against secrecy in this country now because we just don't trust anyone, you know.
Yeah.
And so we have journalists.
Right?
Well, that is a good thing. I mean, we can't trust anyone at this point. Trust no one, you know, it's the famous slogan of the X-Files, and I think it's coming back to bite us on the ass, you know.
Yeah.
We can't trust anyone. This is the problem. And our politicians have created this situation. They're the ones who are responsible for it. So they can't cry like Freemasons, you know, who cry that they're being, you know, besmirched, that their reputations are being ruined by all this paranoia. When you're secret, if you're secret and everything you do is secret, well, don't cry about it if we think you're up to no good.
Yeah.
The same thing with our elected officials.
And then you have that the whole question that you touched upon, of course, that many of the people in the elite are above the law. They can simply circumvent that through various things, through lawyers, but just by not telling anyone what simply is going on. And it's not until years later when we finally find out what has been going on, the people might have been dead or not in a position anymore to be prosecuted for those things. So that's another problem. They don't ask anybody if, you know, can we do this, please? They just go ahead and do it. And if it's discovered or not, you know, that's if they're discovered, that's unfortunate to them. But if they're not, then that's a benefit to them. So that's another problem, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, as Nixon famously once said, you know, if the president does it, it's not illegal. Well, since when? You know,
yeah.
Where does it say that in the Constitution? But this is the idea. They're above the law. People find themselves in that position of thinking that the masses of people are just too stupid to know what we're doing, that we're doing the best for them. And of course, they don't really believe that. In their heart of hearts, they're doing what's best for themselves, not what's best for society. But anyway, they have their own agendas, and they think that what they're doing is right. They think they're making the hard decisions. But that's not their job. Their job is to defend the Constitution. In our case, their job is to defend the United States from enemies, you know, domestic and foreign, but within the context of our Constitution, not just to go out and hire a hitman to go and kill somebody, you know, or to torture somebody until they give up, you know, whatever it is we want them to give up. That's not what we're about. And I think that a lot of Americans find themselves now in the position of having to suffer the consequences of this by everyone thinking that Americans are that way, that we're all Dick Cheney, you know, that we're all George Bush. This is who we are as people. And there's a lot of discontent in this country right now because we've been forced into this position of having to defend torture in order to defend patriotism, in order to defend what it means to be an American. And a lot of Americans are just very upset with this. They can't swallow it. And, you know, this all came about because of secrecy, because of the Patriot Act, you know, which gave the president and the government tremendous powers to do things that they wanted to do without, you know, asking anyone's permission. And that's always a bad thing. You know, they always ask you, are you willing to give up, you know, liberty for security? And I'm not,
no,
you know.
No.
I'll give up some security for liberty. I mean, I'll take my chances.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, otherwise, what do I have? If I give up my liberty, do I have any security? You know,
yeah.
I don't have any security left, do I?
That's right.
So
if we go back a little bit more in history, I guess, and talk about the roots of Masonry, and with that we can even dive into a little bit of the rituals and so forth later on. But have you found that the roots are to be found in Jewish mythology or theology? Are they Christian in origin? What are the roots here, Peter?
Well, probably the most fun I've had with this book, The Secret Temple, has been the rituals themselves and trying to identify where they came from, because this is crucial. The rituals are so strange by any religious standards, by any orthodox religious standard, that it really cries out for analysis. There is, of course, a Jewish connection in that the temple is itself Solomon's temple. There is the the idea that this is a recreation of Solomon's temple. So that automatically is Jewish. And the book of the law, as they call it, which is present in every Masonic initiation ceremony, can be the Bible, or it could be the Torah, or it could be the Quran, or almost anything, which is a religious scripture. It's a requirement of a Freemason that they believe in God. Past that, there's no other requirement. If you're an atheist, you cannot become a Freemason. That's about the only stricture where that's concerned. But there's the Solomon's Temple is there. The various initiation rites, there are three major ones, first, second, and third degree, are all based on Solomon's Temple. So that's there. But, you know, there's the central ceremony of the third degree is the death and resurrection of the initiate, of the third degree initiate. And this could be seen as a Christian, illusion. Even though, again, it refers directly to the building of Solomon's temple in the ritual. But it could be seen as something else. And I have made a case in the secret temple, and people are going to find difficulty with this, I know. I've made a case that I do believe that there is a Templar origin to some of these rituals and to the Masons themselves. Historians have attacked this idea because they say, well, the Knights Templar were suppressed in the early 14th century. By 1317, 1320, there were no more Knights Templars officially anywhere. And the Freemasons didn't come around till the 18th century, till the United Grand Lodge in the 1700s. Well, that's not exactly true. There have been Masonic initiation rituals discovered that date back to the 14th century in Scotland. So you had Masons going through the 3 degrees of initiation, well, in those days, 2 degrees of initiation, almost identical in format to the way Masons are initiated today. And these rituals were in documents that have been dated to the late 14th century, about 50 or 60 years after the suppression of the Knights Templar. So that's pretty close. And their leader, the leader of the Knights Templar, Jacques de Molay, was burned at the stake, was killed, was handed over by people he trusted, a pope and a king. He was conspired against and murdered. And I think that this murder at the heart of the third degree is an allusion to Jacques de Molay and the Templar history. Mm-hmm. So I believe that there is a Templar connection, and I try to make that case in the Secret Temple, that that we have to revisit this, that it wasn't just some kind of romantic idea that linked the Templars to the Masons. After all, the Catholic Church condemned Freemasonry most clearly. Just as they had the Templars at the time. There was a lot of anti-church sentiment in those early days of Freemasonry. And I think it may stem from a Knights Templar connection, but this is something that I think, that I found. And I'll let my documentation speak for itself. It's certainly open to interpretation, and I'm certainly willing to accept a different point of view.
What about the whole idea that these two different, seemingly, at least historically, rivaling factions, the Knights Templar and the Catholic Church, that they actually have been brought back together now, not too many years ago. We had something called the Chinian Parchment, I think, which kind of clears
yes.
the Knights Templar and what they've been doing. And the Catholic Church have once again embraced them and brought them back into the Catholic Church. What's your take on that? What does that mean?
Well, it's interesting because obviously the documents have been in the Vatican archives for the last, 700 years? So somebody knew that this had happened, that the Templars had been cleared of all the charges of heresy and blasphemy. This is a very important document. It says pretty much what we all thought all along, was that the Templars were set up, that this was a power grab by the King of France at the time, Philippe le Bel, who basically forced the Pope to undertake this major investigation of the Templars. So this embrace of the Templars, well, you know, the Pope forgave the Jews famously, about 50 years ago. They forgave Galileo not too long ago. I mean, they're doing all of this. You know, they're trying to go back and, you know, redress some of their sins. I don't know that the Templars themselves, I mean, there are no Templars anymore unless we count the Freemasons as Templars. So what does that do for the church? It's kind of easy to forgive Galileo because he's been dead for a couple of hundred years. He's not going to sue you. The Knights Templar are not going to sue you. It's pretty safe. So who's left? So I think it's nice gesture, but it doesn't, mean very much in the grand scheme of things. Hmm. But what does it do for the Freemasons? Freemasons are still under, a shadow. Pope John Paul I was going to clean out the Freemasons from the Catholic Church because he realized that so many bishops and even cardinals were members of Propaganda Due, of this Italian Masonic lodge. And of course, he died 30 days into his papacy under mysterious circumstances. So I don't know. I'm a little cautious about when the church, does things like this. I'm always afraid of Greeks bearing gifts. So I don't know what the church has in mind with all of this, but I don't know if it's anything sinister, but I have an open mind.
Yeah, and I think he even died 33 days after, which might be a hint in terms of numerology to Freemasonry. And then you have the whole, again, tying back to the P2 thing that you mentioned before with Banco Ambrosiano and the whole, the Vatican banker, and that the fact that he was killed in a kind of semi-Freemasonic ritualistic way under the Blackfriars Bridge in London. Forget his name now, but... So that's also things that are going on. Do you think that all of this is to blame Freemasonry for some of these things, or what does that hint to anything at all in terms of symbolic value?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the symbolic value of this, it's of course really, really stunning. I mean, I write about coincidence a great deal, as in Sinister Forces. Mm. So this always had, tremendous resonance for me. So looking at the 33 days of Pope John Paul I, of course, is very significant because he was an enemy of Freemasonry. And I think it was Roberto Calvi, wasn't it, who was hung under the bridge at Blackfriars Bridge. Again, a member of P2, and was he being silenced? And the Freemasons have come out and said, well, not really. This is not really that significant for this reason or that reason. But as usual, their arguments were very hollow to me. Just as their arguments that the Freemasons had nothing to do with the revolution, was quite hollow. They insist that they had nothing really to do with that. They were not organized. They were not conducting. They didn't have safe houses, where Masons could meet and, during the revolution, which is all nonsense. It's been proven true, so I don't know. As I say, the sinister implications of all of this are much broader than identifying a particular person and a particular event or a particular organization. When we see the resonance flow out from these events with symbolic numbers and symbolic locations, you ask yourself, is this deliberate? Was it really a conspiracy by human beings who got together and decided this was how it was going to be done? Or was it something deeper, something darker, what I call the sinister forces? Are these coincidences then evidence of something more cosmic at work behind the scenes? Mm. Which doesn't mean that people are not involved. As I mentioned in Sinister Forces, I believe that, people have been able to get in touch with these darker forces and perhaps manipulate them for their own ends. So it's a perfect way to commit a crime, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the long distance, voodoo doll approach, to kill at a distance or to, the men who stare at goats now is the famous film that's going to be opening this week in New York, which is based on remote viewing and an actual military program of trying to kill at a distance. So, when you're dealing with that kind of evidence, spectral evidence like that, you're really, then you just throw up your hands and say, well, okay, well, who do we prosecute in a case like this?
Yeah. So if we kind of a little bit continue on that theme, the dark forces or the sinister forces, and tie that together with the possibility that these are contacted through the aid of rituals and ceremonies and so forth, and tied together with Freemasonry, I've heard from some researchers who even claim that when you participate in a traumatizing initiation like that allegedly goes on within Freemasonry when you're being brought into the lodge, that in itself can be viewed upon as a form of mind control, that you're traumatizing someone into enough to make them pledge their allegiance to the order or to the group even more. I don't know how far we can extend that and what actually happens, but is that something that you've been thinking about when you're researching some of the rituals of Freemasonry as well?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's the core element of my work is the fact that ritual itself, what I call shamanic or shaman-like processes, is a technology. And our own government in the United States in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s was utilizing these same processes to create the perfect assassin, for instance, in an attempt to find a Manchurian candidate, if you will. That they use spiritual practices, but without spiritual safeguards. So they were plumbing the depths of mystical and occult practices in order to find out how to manipulate the human mind. That's because these rituals do that. A traumatic experience under ritual circumstances does cause a change in consciousness. It has to. That's the whole purpose. And the trauma, any kind of trauma, will cause a change in consciousness. But when you add trauma to a ritual circumstance filled with symbols, filled with strange language and the theater of ritual, combined with the trauma, you're exerting a tremendous effect on the consciousness of that person. Now, that's just Masonic ritual. If we now go to something more dramatic, more drastic, to ritual magic, to occult initiations that are more, that are deeper in a sense, or more violent in nature, involving sacrifice of animals, for instance, things like that, you are tapping into levels of the human consciousness that normally we're not aware exist. And what is the purpose? When you tap into that consciousness, when you approach that level of awareness, aren't you also releasing a certain amount of power, of ability? If you can see more than other people, if you can reach further than other people, if time and space themselves become malleable, become flexible because of these experiences, you suddenly have a degree of power over other people you did not have before. In the case of the CIA and their operations under MK Ultra, Operation Bluebird, Artichoke, and all the others, they were doing this to people, but in a very amateurish, haphazard way. They didn't know what they were doing. They just knew that if we use drugs, if we use hypnosis, if we use certain types of psychological conditioning, we will break people down. We will erase their memories. We can give them new memories. We can make different people out of them. It was a playground of occult techniques applied in a laboratory setting. And it's very bizarre to me, and it still is to this day. So when you talk about Freemasonry and those 3 degrees of initiation, if done correctly, they should cause a change in consciousness. Mm. It should cause the person, if nothing else, to become bonded to that group. I mean, Charles Manson did it, you know. Mm. Jim Jones did it. These are people that are more famous, but there's a lot of people who we've never heard of who are doing this all the time. Whether in government or out of government, whether privately or publicly, they are manipulating the consciousness of their followers through dramatic ritual and using drugs and using hypnosis, using chanting, using music in certain ways, affecting all the senses. This is what magical ritual is all about. It's a control of your environment by controlling your sensory input. You know, the color of the candles and the smell of the incense and the sound of the bell or the chanting. All of these things are conspiring to create a kind of sensory laboratory. Not a sensory deprivation chamber, but a sensory deprivation chamber, but controlled with one particular type of message that gets beamed into your mind. So I think that's what's taking place, whether it's Masonic ritual, Skull and Bones, famously, with their rituals, or any other kind of occult ritual, or even just groups of people who are meeting secretly, tend to form this kind of group consciousness. And there's a kind of group power that's released, I think, when those people meet.
That is, well, that is really creepy, actually. And you know, what about the idea then if we talk about, that you mentioned before, that many Masons don't know what they actually are doing in terms of the ritual. There is a recipe there, obviously, then, and it's still alive today. That implies in one way that it's still working. Is this an ancient recipe that they use, and for that reason, it carries that energy with it, if you will. It's something that has survived throughout our society for a long, long time. And I guess even as a question on top of that would be, you know, I have this difficulty understanding why people would want to go into something and pledge allegiance to something that they don't know what it is ahead of time, because they don't exactly. know what it is before they go in there, but then they agree to go and try it out and see what it does to you. And that's kind of tricky to me. What's your take on that, Peter?
Well, I'm laughing because, of course, I mean, that's what people do. You know, they join Freemasonry without knowing anything about it. And quite often the people who are in Freemasonry also don't know. So it's this weird, desire to belong to something. And I think this idea of connecting with a group of like-minded people has become really strong, especially when in cyberspace we're connected to thousands of people and thousands, but we don't really connect. We don't really know them. We don't shake their hands. We don't have coffee with them. Here in Freemasonry, we've given you a group that you can belong to, and we have secrets, and you're special. You know, all you have to do is go through these rituals. All you have to do is have your consciousness awakened in a specific way. You know, and you'll be one of us. Now, I think that in many cases, these rituals can be enacted sloppily. They can be done very badly by inept people. And perhaps it doesn't work then. And maybe that's what you find in a lot of Masonic temples. I don't know. But I think that the rituals are done properly with people who believe what they're doing and who are expert at performing these rituals. Then I think you have an engine of consciousness that's very powerful. And I think that's the difference.
Do you take any stance in terms of if it's for good or if it's for bad? I mean, again, you expressed earlier your worry over the fact that many leaders have a religious background. Here we have an organization then that demands that you have a belief in a higher or supreme being or the grand architect or you know, pick a religion, whatever. It doesn't matter, just as long as you feel that you're associated with one. Does that scare you as well, then?
Well, not so much the idea of believing in a god doesn't particularly bother me. It's the other things that go along with it that bother me. I didn't care that Ronald Reagan, for instance, believed in God. That didn't matter to me. The fact that he belonged to the Disciples of Christ, which was an apocalyptic sect to which Jim Jones also belonged, that bothered me. You see, it depends on the context very heavily. So if somebody comes over to me and says, oh, they're a Freemason, they join this lodge in Ohio somewhere, you know, and it's a bunch of guys who work in the factory and, you know, stuff like that, I'm not too particularly worried. But if somebody comes up to me as a Freemason and they're also a member of, I don't know, the Central Intelligence Agency, or, you know, they're involved in the military in some way and they're in a military lodge and et cetera, I may not necessarily be immediately on my guard, but I do wonder what the hell they talk about. You know, in those lodges. I mean, why are they there? Why do they feel if they're in the military or if they're in an intelligence agency or if they're in a church, for instance, what is the need to belong to this society? What is that society giving them that they're not getting out of society in general? I mean, that's the question that I had for the Freemasons in general. They would say, well, we're not religious. You know, we teach people ethics and morality. That's their standard line. And I say to them, but you have to believe in God. You all belong to churches of some kind. Don't the churches teach morality and ethics? What is Freemasonry doing that is so different from what your church is doing that you must go to Freemasonry to get education in morals and ethics? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Have the churches, you know, fallen apart and they're not doing their job? Is that why Freemasonry came back so strongly? I don't think so. I think it's something else entirely. And I think people are not being honest about what they're getting out of Freemasonry.
That's very interesting. Do you think it's about a deeper connection? I mean, in one way, we kind of go into psychology here. People's need to belong to something. And to me, it's another form of expression of groupthink or the need to belong to a group because you're not, in one way, kind of strong to stand on your own. Do you think that's a factor here? Or is there even something else more sinister going on? Is it that this is connecting into something more ancient, something more, I don't know what to put the word on there. Comments, Peter?
Well, it's deeper because there are organizations you can belong to, the Rotary Club or, you know, the Boy Scouts or something. I mean, there's a lot of societies you can join if you need to connect to people. Freemasonry is specifically secret, and it has rituals of initiation. So that's different. It's in a different category. There's all kinds of groups you can join. You can join your alumni association out of your university or all kinds of things you can join. But when it comes to Freemasonry, there is an aura of power, of secrecy, of secret knowledge, and of spiritual changes that will take place during the initiations. And I think this is what sets Freemasonry and the occult secret societies in general apart from all the others, because there is a process that is taking place with your membership. You don't just simply join and pay your dues and get the newsletter, you know, and have a dinner once a month or something. This is something a bit more involved that requires a lot more of you, a lot more investment of your psyche. So this is the thing that I'm wondering about. This is what I don't fully understand about Freemasonry and its attraction for people. Yes, they want to belong, but why do they have to belong to a society that is secret and that uses ritualistic initiation? I'm not against any of this stuff, you understand?
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand it. I'm not denigrating it. There's a place for initiation. I've written a lot of books about it. There's a place for initiation, for spiritual processes, even for secrecy, especially in a time when our privacy is being invaded so constantly. So I can understand all of those things, but what is it about Freemasonry? Why do people feel drawn to this? What is happening to them in a good lodge, in a lodge that really works the rituals? What is taking place in their heart, in their soul, in their mind? How is it changing them? And this is what I would like to know. This is what I would like to discover. And it's one of the things that's closed because it's very difficult to find people who will talk about it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the question is, can you understand it from the outside, or do you need to join to understand? And if you do so, can you protect yourself from the initiation process? I mean, I have no interest at all in going into this organization. I don't know if you have, but let's say that one would have the interest in doing that. Can you protect yourself in any way with another ritual on top of this, so to speak, to not be affected by it? That might be the intention of the initiation.
Well, as Groucho Marx once famously said, I wouldn't want to join any organization that would have me as a member. So, no, I'm not interested in joining Freemasonry. But that's catch-22, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
In order to find out about Freemasonry, really, you would have to join it. And protecting yourself against the ritual seems to be counterproductive. You would have to experience the ritual to know what it was, to know what it was about. So it's a problem, and it's a problem that everyone has with Freemasonry who write about it. If you are a Freemason, you are bound by your oath not to reveal certain things. There is no way out. If you're not a Freemason, then you don't know those things you're not supposed to reveal. So it's catch-22. How can you write about Freemasonry? And I struggle with that in my own book. And I say you can learn about it through the rituals that have been printed many times, published many times. You can learn about it through the actions of their members. You can try to build a picture of it that way. And that's what I've tried to do in Secret Temple. Try to understand Freemasonry through its rituals, through its history. Try to understand the effect it has. Is it necessarily an evil organization, or is it just a spiritual organization that we don't understand?
The rituals that have been leaked, so to speak, through various publications and books throughout the year, do you think that they are correct, or could that be a diversion as well? What do you think?
Based on my own conversations with Freemasons, active Freemasons, those three basic rituals are pretty much identical. I mean, they're the ones that they use.
Mm. Well, it's very, very interesting. And I mean, ultimately, again, you mentioned this idea that you struggle with this question. But, again, to kind of just dovetail a little bit back on this, and we can begin to round things up on that note, Peter. But what do you think is the goal then is of this organization? Is it just to grow and expand, or is there another purpose that's being served through this organization for whatever means? We hear about the term, for instance, that you're being you're being shaped from the rough ashlar to the polished stone, so to speak. And to me, that's another way of an analogy of being fit into the brick wall, so to speak. They're building something with you, you know, in that sense.
A Pink Floyd reference.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But I see it as that, actually, in one way. And I don't know if that's, you know, correct or not, but I see that they're trying to build Solomon's temple with the aid of you. Do you think that that's the case, or is there something else going on here?
Well, I mean, you've brought up so many some heavily laden symbolic references that I'm now struggling with the picture. I've got Pink Floyd and the wall on one hand, and I have Solomon's Temple on the other, and you know, it's causing this sort of cortical fission taking place in my brain. Yeah, I mean, yes, they are building Solomon's temple. I mean, the secret temple is Solomon's temple. After Solomon's temple was destroyed, Jewish mystics tried to create the temple symbolically through their mystical practices. And I believe that Freemasonry is part of that tradition of building a spiritual temple, of building a temple, you might say, in the ether or on the astral plane, you know, a temple that will withstand anyone's attempt to destroy it. So as a Freemason, I believe you are part of the temple. You are a member, a brick in the wall, and you're building that temple. And I think that all Freemasons are, in a way, building that temple. They're polishing their stone. They're becoming a perfect stone. And you ask yourself, why would anyone want to be a perfect stone? I mean, why would you aspire to that? Of course, it's a metaphor for rounding out the edges, the rough edges of your personality, perhaps, or something. But there's also the implication, as you point out, that you're designed to be fit somewhere. And perhaps that's what Freemasonry is about. It's building a new temple. It's building the spiritual temple in which every member is one stone. And then you ask yourself, is that a noble aspiration for an individual? And that, I think, is something that people have to answer for themselves. As I say, I wouldn't join. I haven't joined any organizations of that nature at all. But and I have a resistance against it because I don't know what will be demanded of me in return. This is something that's always there, that's always sitting out. I don't want to keep anyone's secrets that way, you know. Not secrets in my field, you know. If I'm writing about Freemasonry, I don't want to know like the ultimate secret and realize everything I've written is crap, and now I have to go back, you know, and rewrite it. And I can't rewrite it. I'm not allowed to rewrite it. I'm not allowed to correct my misconceptions. That would bother me. So I would rather not know.
Well, good point, Peter. And again, the book is called The Secret Temple, Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America. Do check it out through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And again, Peter's website, sinisterforces.info. Thank you very much for coming back, Peter. It's been very interesting having you back on. Are you currently working on something new, or are you taking a little break from your last book here?
Well, I'm involved in a couple of projects now. We'll see what happens. One is on Tantra. Asian perspectives on Tantra with a lot of photographs and a number of different projects I'm working on right now.
Okay, keep up the great work, Peter, and thank you again so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I had a great time.
That's our 2 hours with Peter Lavenda. Thank you for joining us here in the member section and for your support of Red Ice. We will be back with more radio soon. Nick Rosen on how to escape the Big Brother system and how to live off-grid. We have John Cale with us to talk about the Masonic star map of Charleston, South Carolina, and Sabina DeVita joining us to talk about electromagnetic pollution. Keep your eye on redicecreations.com for much more. My thanks to Friedrich and Elizabeth. We will talk more soon. Take good care.